Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We appreciate you joining us for another live Midrats, and for those that are getting with the podcast, we're glad to have you there as well. But if you are with us live, I would like to do my usual altar call. And if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that is where you will find the chat room. If you want to, go ahead and jump in there. That's a great place during the course of the show to share any observations you have. We'll be watching it during the course of the show, and we will take anything we find there, and we will try to roll it into the conversation. If you have some questions you want us to ask, that's also a great place to put it with your observations. And we already have some good company. We've already got almost half dozen folks there, so please join in. And as always, if you've got to run off and take care of some things and you've got to miss a part of the show, if you don't already, go ahead and go over to iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Find Midrats and go ahead and subscribe to it. That way we will be waiting for you at a time of your convenience. And on today's show, for anybody over 85, one thing about being an American is you never have really existed at a time when the U.S. Navy was not the premier naval power. And the closest powers for a lot of that time were friends of ours. And no one alive has seen where the Navy was not the premier power in the Pacific. Though on paper, you know, we were challenged by the Royal Navy for a little bit, though they were mostly our friends for the last century. And in World War II, the Imperial Japanese Navy did give us a pretty good run for a few years. But at the end, after the 1930s, there was no industrial power that if they took time to look at what could be done, could compete with the United States in the production of warships ready to fight for any major conflict coming up and being able to sustain that fight. And for period during the Cold War, there was a couple of decades where the Soviet Union was building up a blue water fleet, but outside of the regions closest to it, she really wasn't a major concern. And here we are approaching the end of the first quarter of the 21st century, and a rising power in the Pacific is challenging the U.S. Navy's traditional and comfortable position in those waters, and it's also starting to do it on the global scale. And a lot of our leaders don't seem to be in a position where they either want to or are comfortable looking at this challenge. And that, of course, is the People's Republic of China. She's clearly sent a signal that not only does she want to challenge the position of the United States as a leader in the world community, she wants to challenge us in our position on the high seas in the international order that it underwrites. And today we have a returning guest, and we're going to use kind of the kickoff point for our conversation, a recent article in The Atlantic titled, "The Age of American Naval Dominance is Over." And the author is a your friend of mine, Jerry Hendricks, Ph.D. Jerry is a retired Navy commander, author, a senior fellow with the Sagamore Institute in Indianapolis. And his most recent book that we've had him on Midrats to talk about before, back in 2020, was To Provide and Maintain a Navy. Jerry, welcome back to Midrats. It's great to have you aboard.
Hey, Sal and Eagle One, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on to talk about this topic. And obviously, this show where I've been before and talking with you guys that I've done many times before is the perfect place to kind of unpack the numerous arguments, you know, put forth in this this new essay.
Well, what a great way to spend an afternoon. I almost wish we could steal a couple of hours from you, but your wonderful wife may not be gracious enough to spare you for more than an hour. But before we dive in to your article, and this is something that you and I have talked about offline, but I want to share this discussion with our guests, is talk a little bit about venue and a little bit about a trend line here. And your article is published in The Atlantic, and I know I wrote about it, and you and I discussed it at about the time. But when you go back to November of 2007, 16 years ago, this article can drive now. There was an article in The Atlantic by Robert D. Kaplan in the November of 2007 titled America's Elegant Decline. And it was, as yours is, focused on American naval power and where it looks at it. And he kicks off the article in something, his article, in something that I could just feel the same, if not point of view, concern, knowledge, a feeling of a disturbance in what should be a normal rhythm. I'm going to quote Kaplan here for a little bit. This is from his November 2007 article, quote, "Holes in the water could soon display boots on the ground as the most important catchphrase of our time, but our Navy is stretched thin. How we manage declining naval resources will go a long way towards determining our future standing in the world," unquote. And it's important to go back and remember where we were in 2007 when he wrote that. That was at the height of the surge in Iraq. Afghanistan was assumed to be mostly won at that time and was a NATO-run operation. And it's also that the timing is interesting because 2007, if they look back 16 years, would have been 1985, pretty close to the peak of the Cold War Soviet military power, as it is from 2007 to today, just to give people a context of the time frame. And, you know, looking back at Kaplan's article and the discussions you've had so far with yours that you put out, how do you think Kaplan looks 16 years later?
Well, prescient. I mean, and you know, I was fortunate enough after I retired from the Navy to work for a few years at the Center for New American Security, where Bob Kaplan had an office, you know, a couple rows down from me. And so, you know, he and I had a chance to sit down and talk, you know, quite a bit about, you know, his writing previous, the things he was thinking about then and where he wanted to go next. But, of course, that was one of the very first conversations that I had with him, was about that essay in The Atlantic and how much it had captured my attention at the time. And because I was still 7 years away from retirement, was still actually in San Diego in command of my squadron at that point in time. And this thing just, you know, hit the presses, got carried over into the early bird, got distributed by Navy leadership. Virtually everybody in the Navy saw this. And I thought at the time that it was kind of really important that someone of Kaplan's stature and something like The Atlantic would cover the issue, that perhaps this would be the thing that would cause people to sort of shift their focus, to pay more attention to it, to increase the investments in it. And unfortunately, as you and I both know, you know, within a decade of Kaplan's essay coming out, the Navy actually reaches its nadir. It reaches to 271 ships. You know, just a few years later after that, we have the year, you know, the terrible year with the collisions and the groundings and the deaths of sailors. And we, you know, this palpable sense that the fleet was overstretched and broken, not being maintained, being asked to do too much with too little. And so, you know, you just look at Kaplan's essay and then think, you know, 10 years, and then now, you know, we're more than 15 years on from Kaplan. And we're exactly where Bob said we were going, and we seem unable to kind of shift away from that trajectory that we're on. I also think going back some 15, 20 years before that, about an essay that I read while I was still a midshipman at the Naval ROTC unit at Purdue University in West Lafayette. I had a part-time job working at a drugstore as a cashier at the time to help pay my way through college, and The Atlantic came out with an essay that was written by a gentleman whose last name was Beatty that had a critique of the 600-ship Navy and the maritime strategy that come out of the Reagan administration. And I remembered it quite distinctly. In fact, I kept a photocopy, and talking like an old photocopy, not sort of a modern copy, around in my files for years afterwards, because I thought that it had done a rather in-depth exploration of not only the maritime strategy, but the reasons for it, where the holes were in that strategy. And so it sort of represented a pinnacle, a standard, as it were, of looking at the Navy and looking at naval strategy in a very open and accessible forum. And so I would tell you that for years I've had a bucket list item to be able to write something in the Atlantic, not just with the idea of writing in the Atlantic, you know, really sort of gives you an imprimatur that, hey, you know, now you're a writer, but also the fact that the Atlantic reaches a very particular audience. And so, you know, having written for years now in the Naval Institute Proceedings and then at National Interest and also National Review, the idea of reaching the Atlantic's audience, which is distinct and separate from the audiences I'd spoken to previously, was really something that was really important to me and I've worked on. And of course, I can't help but just make mention of the fact, because I mentioned it in the essay itself, that the Atlantic was the place from which Alfred T. Mahan launched a lot of his public dialogue with the American people, having published in it in 1890, and also Theodore Roosevelt himself, who I admire and written my own doctorate on, he was a writer for the Atlantic. So to me, it was this was a goal, and I'm really pleased that the editors worked with me on this essay.
As you write this, when you wrote this essay, did you, and you get to see it published in a major magazine like the Atlantic, do you see that maybe we're turning the corner on sea blindness? Is this like the beginning salvo of the intellectual powers in the U.S. beginning to wake up to the fact that we're a maritime nation?
Well, I hope so. I mean, and obviously that's, you know, I went into this with this as a goal. But I will tell you that it won't be the turning point unless it becomes the beginning of a conversation. And so I've gotten some really great feedback, a lot of, you know, compliments via email and other forms of communication. There's a couple, you know, modes of communication that I had that I hadn't used in years, and suddenly I was getting, you know, text messages, you know, via, you know, various backgrounds on this. LinkedIn has become a real interesting area of communication. But with everybody who reaches out and says, hey, great essay, I really like what you said here, I disagreed with what you said there, my comeback to them is, well, then please write about it. Please write an op-ed in your local newspaper, whether it's the Indianapolis Star back in my home state, the Chicago Tribune. You know, the only way this becomes a national dialogue is, in fact, we have a national dialogue. If you start from a place and try to drumbeat it so that everyone can become more aware of the issues at hand. You know, if I missed an issue that you think is important within this Atlantic essay, please raise that issue someplace else. You know, reference back to my essay. I'd be really pleased if you did that. But please take that your issue and say, Hendricks got it mostly right, but here's the thing he missed, and I would really like to read that.
Now, Jerry, I just love your call there for people to talk where they are, where they can about this topic, because I think that's a lot of the problem is there aren't enough people who care about this to talk about it, whether they agree or not. I know you and I both are from the 80-20 rule. You know, if we agree with 80%, you're my close friend. You know, we'll work on the 20%, but you're 80. So a lot of people that for a variety of reasons, they're holding back, and we need more of that discussion. And, you know, part of it is there's a frustration and you look for things to get hooks on people. And different ways and different voices, I think, not unlike how you've done in the Atlantic, where you're reaching a new audience. But I think if you have more diversity of informed people writing on this in different venues, they're going to explain things a certain way. I'm a numbers person. I love numbers. But oftentimes, that's not going to get the hook in, so to speak. For instance, again, 2007 is a wonderful data point to look at. And I got some numbers. And again, everybody's number can vary a little bit depending upon what you count. But the NHHC back in 2007, they said the U.S. Navy had 279 ships for how they counted it. And in 2021, we're at 290, which, depending upon your sources, you can be plus or minus from there. That was just kind of the mean average of how I got it, which seems, oh, okay, well, that's 11 ships up, comma, however. The Office of Naval Intelligence back in 2007 put out, they're not numbers people, so they didn't have my graphs and my grids of numbers like I like to see in a report like you get from the our friend over at the Congressional Oversight. But they called in their report that if you look at destroyers, frigates, subs, amphibs, and missile boats, the People's Republic of China, their Navy, had 220 warships. If you use those same numbers, you have to use the different sources because I couldn't find ONI had done a similar report recently. You get the People's Republic of China, their Navy, between 348 and 363 ships. And when you look at 2007, what America was building, you can't, I don't think, do the relative numbers right, because the quality, not just the quantity, but the quality of the ships that the Chinese industry is pushing out right now is much better than it was in 2007, and it includes things like aircraft carriers. And you hear a little bit of it in informed circles, but is part of our sea blindness, in a way, it's somewhere between entitlement or just refusing to see that huge challenge that it's not pacing, as you hear people say, it's accelerating, and if depending on how you measure it, last year it passed us.
Well, I think sort of the sea blindness, and the way that I lay this out in the argument is that, you know, there is almost no one alive today that can remember a time when the sea was not in its present condition, meaning essentially a free open sea, you know, free for trade, that you could pass ships unmolested from one location to almost anywhere else on the planet, with very little chance of being interdicted or raided by pirates, or that there would be a foreign power that wants to come aboard and pull you over and do some sort of a safety and health inspection at sea as a means of harassing another nation's commerce. That just simply doesn't exist, and it hasn't existed since the end of World War II. And so it's not just, you know, the young generation or even my generation, or it's my parents' generation, the baby boomers, that were born after World War II. They simply have not lived in a world where the maritime environment was contested in any real meaningful way. And so now that we're beginning to see this competition, now that China is outpacing us by a wide margin in maritime production, not just naval production, but maritime production. They're the largest merchant shipbuilder in the world, and there's an intrinsic tie between their ability to spit out surface combatants and their ability to spit out commercial container ships or tankers or anything else. And so, you know, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to raise this, is that, you know, we are walking blind, this sea blindness, into a new era. And it would not be shocking to me to wake up one day and say that, you know, some portion of the world's oceans have been closed off to us, and then begin to see some significant increases in the cost of shipping because we have to reroute and so on, which is one of the reasons I sort of raised that alternative reality, that it's easy to kind of now imagine this type of environment so that we can start getting that into our own minds. The other thing, too, Sal, is we all have kind of just ignored the degree to which our current economy is tied to the sea. And, you know, I make the point in the essay that, look, you know, if you want to go to Walmart or Costco or BJ's Wholesale Club, or you buy your materials at Home Depot and or Lowe's, you know, as we do so often that they practically wave at my wife when she walks in, the fact is all of that is dependent upon, you know, container ship shipping that comes from overseas. So our entire economy has shifted from sort of small town economy to these large big box stores, and all the big box stores are supplied from the sea. And so if you try to imagine a world where the sea is contested, well, that economy looks dramatically different with us. I mean, that would have a significant impact on us in our day-to-day lives. So this is one of the reasons I wanted to raise this issue in the Atlantic and get it out to that broader audience and create this broader conversation is, you know, just get people to understand how much the seas, the Atlantic, Pacific Ocean, are actually tied to our quality and standard of life. We can talk all we want about the fact that, hey, the Chinese ships, yeah, they've got more ships, but they're not as good as ours. It's like, well, it really doesn't matter. You know, when you outdistance me by 100 ships and you've got missiles on those ships, even if they're of a lower quality and going to have a lower survival rate, you will outmass me in the next competition if it flashes hot. So I just think that we've sort of got to get our mind around the fact that the strategic environment has dramatically changed just in the last 20 to 25 years.
Yeah, speaking of numbers, I was looking at the chart of our surface combatants. 28% of the fleet, surface combatant fleet, consists of minesweepers and LCSs. And I'm just blown away by that, because if we're counting those as major surface combatants, we've got some serious rethinking to do, I think. But, you know, Captain Hughes, you just hit on Captain Hughes. You know, the anybody who's read his book knows that it is not quality that wins all the time, but it sure as heck is quantity, and getting the more ships you oppose, the harder it is to win a sea battle. And I can you kind of talk about that a little more, because I think that's a vital point.
Well, I mean, you know, Captain Wayne Hughes, of course, is not only an iconic tactician and strategist of the Navy, he's also a native-born Hoosier. Wayne actually grew up about 12 miles and 50 years apart from me in northeastern Indiana. He grew up near Wolkeville, and I grew up near Angola, Indiana. So, you know, he and I had many conversations. But you're right, Wayne started to talk, especially when he talked about his new Navy fighting machine, about the importance of a distributed network of smaller combatants, things that could operate, you know, in and around. And he was already beginning to see that the Chinese were making those types of investments. He had a particular interest in the Hubeis and what those meant, and then how that was going to array. And it's kind of interesting, Eagle One, when you make the comment there that you're disturbed by the number of LCSs that we have in the fleet. Well, you know, LCS, you know, depending on which variant you're looking at, is larger than some of the old frigates that we had in the fleet, so far as gross tonnage, that we didn't seem to have a problem with. In many ways, you know, there's been a kind of interesting conversation on Twitter about the German fetish with calling everything, no matter what its size is, a frigate. Is kind of going on in that all of our ship classes have grown, they've gotten heavier. You know, we've got a Zumwalt class destroyer, which is, in fact, you know, the size of a heavy cruiser from times past. You know, names really don't matter anymore. It's the mission set that matters. So I am a little disturbed as we look at the balance and the configuration of the fleet between, you know, LCS as a corvette, and then you got the new frigate coming on, then you got destroyers, which in actuality, you know, because they ton out at about 9,500 to somewhere over 10,000 tons, really are sort of the modern battleships in terms of what they bring to the fight. And, of course, the Ticonderogas, which are disappearing from the fleet, you know, in a rapid succession right now. We don't think about both the fleet architecture, its overall size, and its makeup, and why I need various different types of ships in certain numbers. So one of the points I keep making with regard to the new Constellation class frigate is I want frigates because I want them to be able to operate in waters and in ports that I can't take some of my heavier vessels that have a deeper draft or a broader beam and can no longer operate in some of these confined waters in the archipelagic waters of the Pacific. We need to be out on patrol, cops on the beat, and we need to be able to visit places that perhaps we haven't visited in a generation in order to demonstrate our interest in the areas, provide presence, and uphold the interest in the long run. So, you know, there's a lot of nuance. You know, the Atlantic SA is really a broader strategic a geostrategic, geoeconomic argument, but there's also a lot of things that we need to be talking about. If I can capture somebody's attention with the geostrategic conversation, then I want to kind of talk about fleet architecture, and then I want to talk about the defense industrial base and why it's so hard, you know, but you got to start someplace. You got to capture the attention somewhere.
I can't wait for the Constellation to join the fleet, and I hope we can build as many as our shipyards will allow. But you just finished with a great lead-in to my next question. You're talking about geoeconomics, and you're talking about industrial base. And when you look at American shipbuilding, there's a whole cavalcade of excuses to come out. And you have to kind of back people up depending upon what their priors are. To have a conversation is the fact that the old cliche, because it's true in many respects, decline is a choice. Also, what your industry does is a choice. And I like how you reminded people that a lot of where we are today is a result of decisions by politicians. Therefore, ... even though you can't, it's easier to destroy things than to build things, you can also rebuild things if there are political decisions that are made, and you get resistance from strange places because people will use words like industrial policy. So you have your conservative economist who will go off on a tangent and not like it, and then it's the military. So you have left-wing economists who don't want to do that, and everything gets lost in the middle. And I want to quote a little bit from your article in The Atlantic, which kind of brings us back to back when we were midshipmen. Quote, "The United States is no longer investing in the instrument of sea power as it once did. America's commercial shipbuilding industry began to lose its share of the global market in the 1960s to countries with lower labor costs and to those that had rebuilt their industrial capacity after the war. The drop in American shipbuilding accelerated after President Ronald Reagan took office in 1981. The administration, in a nod to free market principles, began to shrink government subsidies that has supported the industry. That was a choice. It might have gone the other way. Aircraft manufacturers in the United States, citing national security concerns, successfully lobbied for the continued and even increased subsidies for their industry in the decades that followed and got them. It is never a nation's advantage to depend on others for crucial links in its supply chains, but that is where we are. In 1977, American shipbuilders produced more than 1 million gross tons of merchant ships. By 2005, that number had fallen to 300,000, end of quote. Some people have broke the seal on discussing how we can rebuild our shipbuilding industry, but to do so is going to require government action, kind of like, as you outlined, was done for the aerospace industry. What is your view of that state of the argument, and do you hold some optimism that if we can get this conversation continuing, because it ultimately it goes to, yeah, that's a great number, but how are you going to build it? It really does go to, for lack of a better phrase, industrial policy.
Yeah, so obviously industrial policy is something that if you mention it in front of someone center left, you know, they get real excited. And in fact, I've been in those conversations with people where they're saying, well, are you actually willing to say this out loud? And I'm saying, yeah, I'm going to say it. I'm going to write it. It is an area that free market advocates on the center right are opposed to because, you know, their thought is, you know, let the market rule. Well, my point here in the essay, and it's a point that I've made, you know, online and Twitter and elsewhere, much to the distraction of some people like at Cato, is that, you know, I've seen how free markets worked. We've tried this experiment since 1981 when Reagan pulled the subsidies from American commercial shipbuilders. And what we saw is this, as we pulled back, both Europe and Asian shipbuilders increased their subsidies to try and grab that market share, which they did. And so today, you know, number one, two, and three shipbuilders, shipbuilding nations in the world are China, South Korea, and Japan. Europe has some strong shipbuilders that rank in the top 10, but the United States does not. And in fact, as I've said repeatedly, and the Secretary of the Navy has picked up, you know, just one of the 19 shipbuilding yards in China actually outbuilds all U.S. shipyards combined. And so, but there's some collateral damage that's come along with that. So we have seen since the end of the Cold War that the price, the average price of a U.S. Navy ship has doubled in cost. That doubling has come because the price of component parts has gone up, because we've gone down to single source suppliers of some critical parts like drive shafts or pumps or gearing. And also the price of labor has gone up because without the commercial shipbuilding market there helping to create the skilled labor force, then the cost of labor to train and maintain them in the major shipyards where U.S. Navy ships are built, that's gone up as well as they compete for fewer and fewer workers. So when you don't have a thriving industrial sector, then in fact you see competition increase just due to scarcity. And so, you know, I think that at this point in time, as we look at a great power competition, which both administrations, I mean, the Biden administration has essentially carried over the language of the Trump administration, going from the Trump administration's national security strategy in 17 forward, Biden administration has repeated much of the same language. So we appear to have at least a consensus that, yes, China does represent a rising great power threat. So in a world where that exists, then the next step is, okay, so what are you going to do about it? And we've had a lot of talk about using the Defense Production Act to do things like, you know, respond to COVID or baby formula. You know, I'd like to actually see the Defense Production Act now actually used on defense and trying to get some alignment there and prioritization. But in the long run, this is going to have to take a reversal of the Last Supper. And I mentioned this in the essay, William Perry's now infamous 1993 gathering of all the leaders of the defense industrial base to point out that, hey, in the time of scarcity, when defense budgets were going to come down due to numerous peace dividends, they either had to merge or they were going to go away. They were going to die. And so that's when Lockheed and Martin Marietta comes together. That's when General Dynamics buys up a number of companies. That's when Boeing purchases McDonnell Douglas, you know, which itself was a combination of a previous merger. So those all came together, and they did survive. But the point is now as we look, we need to bring more competition into that market. And that means in many ways I think that the government's going to have to put a thumb on the scale. Now, does that mean that I want the government to really seriously intrude in the marketplace? Both yes and no. Yes, I want them to start helping to not only pick some winners and losers, but I also want them to think about a thing called dispersal policy. If you actually think you're going to be in competition with China and that there's a good chance of a war with them, then perhaps you don't want everything to be put in one place where it could get knocked out all at one time. Eisenhower looked at this during the height of the Cold War, and he came up with this idea of a dispersal policy that said, hey, I'm not going to have every rocket missile built by the United States military to be built in Los Angeles, California. He thought that was unwise. And so, you know, the Atlas was built in Los Angeles, but the Titan missile was built in outside of Denver, Colorado. So now we know where our major shipbuilders are building things right now, Maine, Mississippi. Also up in Wisconsin with the new Constellation class, I would like us to continue that dispersal and look at, you know, perhaps even building the large and medium unmanned surface vessels in places like along the Mississippi or even along the Ohio as we did in World War II. I think we also have to pay attention to ship repair and shipbuilding capacity on the American West Coast. You know, you need to have more than just San Diego. I've looked, you know, and Hunter's Point is still vacant. They've not developed it yet, and those dry docks are still there. Mare Island still has three operating dry docks, although a lot of the industrial capacity, the industrial machine shops around there have been turned over and developed as, you know, for other commercial uses. But I'd like to see us make better use of what capacities we have with an idea that setting up your shipbuilding and ship repair industrial base for a wartime environment. If you think that we're heading towards conflict, and I do, then you really need someone with a Carl Vinson-like vision of what that looks like to pass a Two-Ocean Navy Act in 1940 that gets you a fleet that can win by 1943. All these things are long lead, and so that's another reason that I've raised those particular topics and those examples in this essay.
Yeah, I'm going to get back to this strategic view, because one of the parts of the article I thought was particularly important is where you talk about Russia and China have sought to extend their territorial claims to international waters, the aim being to control the free passage of shipping near their shores and in their perceived spheres of influence, to control and limit the close, as you say, I think, the global commons.
Yeah.
And how do we, I mean, that's the key thing that we've got to fight against. We're, you know, how do we convince the American people this is really the nut of why we need a strong Navy and why we got to put more money into developing both our Navy and our merchant marine and all the other things that make up aspects of a sea power?
Well, I tried to use the two examples that are immediate and proximate in the American popular memory right now. So I talked about the Ever Given getting lodged in the Suez Canal, you know, 2 years ago, and what happened with disruption in the global markets. And then I also raised, you know, the 100-plus ship backup off the port of Los Angeles, you know, from last year, in which, you know, we tried to clear the backlog from the COVID year off, and we got really strung out. So, you know, you take any opportunity where you can talk with somebody and remind them about our tie to the ocean and just how much commerce comes to the United States or leaves the United States by sea. You know, I think it's 90% by value, 80% by volume, or actually I think I got those back. It's 90% by volume, 80% by value of the U.S. GDP essentially travels by sea. And the rest actually, you know, goes electronic or is, you know, internal, et cetera. But the fact is there is, we are tremendously tied to the sea. And if there is a disruption, then you got to take that disruption as a teachable moment. And then you got to tie that commercial disruption to the Navy. And just make them understand that the reason why the ocean works the way it does today is because the Navy was there and it set these new rules, and they are relatively new rules in terms of American or world history. The idea of free trade, free movement from one port to the other is something that we wrote about and we dreamed about for about 300-plus years, and then World War II happens, and then we made it manifest. But it's a relatively new condition. But and that's one of the reasons, you know, I used to go, after I wrote my book back in 2020, I went out and did some on the road, you know, briefs and presentations, and I would go, you know, to Kiwanis or to the American Legion or wherever I could go and have a conversation with somebody about this. And at the end, everyone's like, well, what can we do? And it's like, well, talk about it. You know, get. You know, I'm coming to your community. Is there any other place I can go? Is there a place that you can go to make these ties, to make people understand how these things are all inextricably intertwined with each other? Our tie to the world is via the sea. And it's like I said, it's the sea blindness, the idea that the ocean has become assumed in our American life and in many ways in global life.
Oh, the joys of radio. I could not find my off switch.
it happens.
Switch, always entertaining. Kind of like what I did earlier in the show, I wanted to go back even further, is, you know, what you were just outlining about the importance of trade. You know, there are some things that are universal. One of them is geography. And there was, going back to the Atlantic, the magazine's been around for a while. It has a tradition. And you quote in your article, the article in the Atlantic in 1890 from your friend of mine, Alfred Thayer Mahan, and you stated, quote, this is from your article, the nation's energy should therefore be focused externally on the sea, on maritime trade, and on a larger role in the world, unquote, is the basis of his article. And the article is available online, and people should look at it because there's a lot of commonality there in the fact you have to understand his context. Writing in 1890, he was closer to the American Revolution than we are to 1890 from a time point of view. And he does, you know, spend some time talking about Great Britain and Canada, and looking forward to getting the isthmus of the Panama Canal pierced, as I believe he kept using. But it almost appears to me that one of the things that he was addressing and trying to get his countrymen to focus on is a lot of the same issues that we're looking at here, though the causal effects are different. At his place in time, that was right after the closing of the frontier. We had gotten our North American footprint. We were really focused on our internal markets. That's what we wanted to do, though we were and always had been closely tied to the seas. And he was trying to explain the importance of the seas and the potential of the seas. And you know, here we are in the mid-2020s almost, where we have that connection to the seas, but people don't see it because it's kind of like the water in which fish swim. They just don't realize it. And looking at that argument that he was making and looking at where we are right now, is were there things that they did between 1890 to the end of World War One that helped boost that understanding of the sea, because we just didn't magically appear as a power in 1941. Were there lessons that what he did that we could bring to the conversation today as we try to get people's awareness in the maritime domain?
So it's interesting you say that way, Sal, because when you read the Mahan America Looking Outward essay, he's making an argument that's explicitly anti-protectionist, that we had set up a closed economy, that we had set protectionist measures and tariffs in place to make sure that European manufacturers in particular were not going to be competitive inside the American market, because at that point in time of industrialization, we wanted to protect the American market to allow our industrial economy to develop as strongly as we could. And Mahan's point was, look, we did it. We accomplished that. We are strong. And in fact, we're in such a strong position industrially, economically at this point in time, as well as geostrategically, being on the North American continent as the center point between the European economy and also the Asian economy, that we need to unleash the American economy on the world. And the only way that's going to happen is if we sort of tear down our protectionist barriers, allow other trade to come here and compete, and in doing so, thus, we would gain access to their markets. We would be able to go elsewhere and compete. Now, we're in another moment right now. So we, in many ways, have gone through successive cycles of deregulation. And as I've already mentioned, we had cut our subsidies, but other nations and other areas did not. So Europe still has a number of protectionist policies in place, depending on which product or industry you want to look at. So, for instance, right now we just had this conversation last year about the CHIPS Act, which has kind of freaked out Europe because they're saying, hey, look, the amount of subsidies and support that you're giving to your domestic industries in the area of high tech is not fair. It's not fair to us, and we're not going to be able to compete in that market because of the amount of subsidies. But Europe didn't have any complaints about the amount of subsidies that it was giving to its own electronics, microelectronics industries over the last 25 to 30 years. And this is a point that I'm making, is when I talk about that perhaps we need to engage in subsidies for shipbuilding, is that when you recognize that you are not in a good position to be able to go to war, that in fact our lack of a civilian commercial shipbuilding industry right now represents a national security threat to the United States, and thus we need to step in and sort of have an industrial policy to reinflate that, because we need to have that capacity there in the event of a global emergency. We're sort of in this trying to reach back towards an equilibrium. We got out of an equilibrium, during this last 40, almost 50 years of a cycle time. We need to reach back into that equilibrium so we have a balance between what our national security requirements are and our aspiration to be part of a globalized, free trading, global economy. which is something that we speak a lot about and that we've done a lot about, but quite frankly, other countries and other regions around the world have sort of taken advantage of our aspirational goal to sort of protect their own industries while at the same time trying to sell to us. So I think Mahan, you know, creates sort of a juxtaposition point where we look at where we were then and where he wanted to go, which, by the way, we achieved. By the time we get to World War One, you know, we have a really significant industrial policy in, you know, our industrial base in the United States. The creation of the all-steel Navy beginning in the 1880s and then up through Theodore Roosevelt's administration really is the beginning of the steel industry in the United States. It is the backbone by which the industrial base of the United States transforms itself, is based upon Navy contracts. And so the idea of now going back to that and taking that as an example, a parallel example about how we would reindustrialize our economy, is something I think is well worth looking at, and then also examining at that based upon some of the arguments that Mahan lays out. And by the way, two other guys, Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt, lay out at that same time to say kind of where the America is and where it should be in its place in the world.
Yeah, I had this awful thought, Jerry, while you were talking a minute ago, and I said, you know, Al Gore managed to stir up quite a bit of stuff with his Inconvenient Truth movie. And, you know, all that has done is cost billions of dollars, trillions of dollars to, I don't know, cripple ourselves in some ways. And I thought, you know, we need a movie. What would happen? Paint that scenario. What would happen if we didn't have the free trade? And I can't. I thought, well, you know, that must have been something along those lines made somewhere in the past that talked about the freedom of the ocean and all that stuff. But I can't think of a particularly good movie or anything really that does that. Are you following my logic here? Do we need to have some kind of excitable stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, if you had something, you know, the something that presents the dystopian future of what happens if free trade is abridged, you know, sort of the Hunger Games at sea, as it were, you know, so that you can engage a younger generation in what that looks like. You know, it is something, you know, I've seen something like this in science fiction, you know, sort of with space fleets and so on, where you talk about interdicted trade. Certainly the Honor Harrington universe, which I visit quite often, you know, kind of gets into the differences between free trade and closed trade systems. But there is not anything that sort of you can wrap your mind around. I mean, when I think about it from a fictional standpoint, you know, the only thing that comes close to what happens when the seas get closed is Red Storm Rising, you know, Clancy's, you know, massive tome where, you know, sort of saw a war between us and the Soviet Union at one point in time. But there's really not anything that sort of captured that, not even Stavridis' 2034 really gets into the commercial side of what happens at that war. And you know, deeply explores that. So I think that is something that we need to do, some way of popularizing it in a public conversation. I do know, you know, there hasn't been a Netflix show that sort of presents the world that I'm describing, and perhaps that is something that we need.
Well, hey, while we're on the doom and gloom train here, let me throw something else your way, Jerry, because you you know, you talk about reach back to equilibrium. Well, there might be a little bit of reach back to contested seas. And going back to the 1890, there was a line from Mahan in the article that he talks about, and this is me quoting Mahan here, quote, "Beyond the broad seas, there are markets of the world that can only be entered and contested by a – correction on my part – that can only be entered and controlled – by a vigorous contest to which the habit of trusting and protection by statute does not condone." A little bit of a late 19th century language there, but he's talking about the very cold, hard fact that at least in his living memory, though not in ours, that the system of global access to the seas right now by everybody was not an assumed. There were areas of the seas and countries that your ships could not enter. Do you see any point where if we don't get better in our policy with our friends and allies, that the world order that we enjoy, that the Chinese are a little resentful of because they didn't have a role in creating, that they could be positioning to create an environment that gives the open seas a different context, a different feel, and a different impact on the economy, like we were just talking about before.
Okay. Well, actually, I do. And let me just say as a quick aside, while I am monitoring the chat room for today's, I'm unable to speak and type back to the questions that are arising there. So I just wanted everyone in the chat room to know that I do see that. Look, Sal, I think it's very clear that right now in the South China Sea that China is positioning itself to create a closed sea. And when they want a closed sea, they essentially want to take this area of the high seas and say this is an internal Chinese waters, and if you're going to pass through here, you're only going to pass through here with our permission. And once you get to that stage, it will not only be with our permission, but perhaps with our license and a fee that you pay in order to have free passage through here. And perhaps that fee will be imposed by a pilot who will come on board your ship when you penetrate Malacca until you reach the Chinese port or pass through the Chinese port on the way to Japan. And by the way, if you're going to Japan, I want to charge you a little bit extra there. So this is the way that historically it's gone in the past. And it's similarly, Russia is looking at the same thing along the Great Northern Route as they're producing liquefied natural gas on the north coast of Russia. They're looking as this the Arctic has become warmer and been open for more parts of the year, that they want to load up this LNG and move it along the Great Northern Route through the Arctic Ocean and then down to China, which is becoming their primary energy consumer. And they begin advancing baseline claims and greater arguments that the Arctic Ocean is in fact internal Russian waters. And in fact, you know, some of the things that they're using and citing out of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea would turn that Great Northern Route into internal waters with having a similar legal status as the Mississippi in the United States. And so they want to do this, and that would, you know, again, create a high seas region, which has now become internal or closed sea, mare clausum, not mare liberum, and thus, you know, you start to see this incremental approach to close off portions of the sea. And so, you know, once that happens, you'll see other maritime powers say, well, I'd like to do that with the waters around my land as well, be able to charge fees to gain an increased amount of income, to bring leverage against it. And then you're going to have a cascading failure on this international system of trade. And why is this occurring? Well, it's occurring because nations like the United States and before us Great Britain are no longer there in sufficient size and magnitude to be able to provide the presence to say, no, you're not going to be doing that today. This is going to be the high sea. And if it's not the high sea, you're going to have to challenge me out here with a gray hull, with a white number and a flag and a gun. But we're not large enough now to actually police all those various different areas where the high seas, the free sea is being contested.
Yeah, it leads me to an interesting question. I mean, we have this AUKUS thing going on with the Australians and the UK and for the submarines, and we have other allies around the world that are also dependent on the sea. And I know we went through that phase of the 1,000-ship Navy where we're going to get help from all our allies to enforce the global commons. How does that fit into your picture of the loss of dominance of the maritime domain by the U.S.?
Well, I think when Admiral Mullins, first as CNO and then later as chairman, started to talk about the 1,000-ship Navy, I knew that we were in trouble. Because the one thing that we know and that we knew then as Americans is that allies are great, and I value them. I value our alliance structures greatly. But at the same time, they cannot always be depended upon. There will be times when allies, for right reasons or wrong reasons, are going to choose to withdraw their support for you based upon your foreign policy goals. And I, you know, I have to go no further than France, pushing back against us when we went into Iraq 20 years ago. At that time. So, but if you build your force sizing structure and your strategy around the idea that I'm going to have a global Navy that, that makes use of my allies, and then the ally doesn't show up, then your strategy folds. So the United States has global interests. It is a global superpower. It still has a global system that it helped to create and build. And so it needs a global Navy in order to police, uphold, and administer that system. And it cannot be a Navy that's based upon others. You know, we need to be strong enough. And by and large, by the way, given the size and complexity of our economy, we ought to be able to do this. We still, are an autonomous nation in the sense that, you know, our economy can sort of go on internals. It has enough natural resources that it's not dependent on the import of other things. We ought to, and it's a strong, thriving economy in the sense of its overall size and complexity in the world, that we ought to be able to build a Navy that goes along with it. The fact that we don't, that we choose to spend our money elsewhere and in lower levels or in higher levels elsewhere and lower levels in our military is a choice that we make. Going back to, Bob Kaplan's essay, that Sal cited, decline is a choice, and we apparently have made it. I'm calling for people to, recognize what it takes to be a thriving great power to be able to uphold your role in the world, which to me is a maritime national security strategy, and asking for people to kind of get behind and support that pivot back, that focused attention back on the maritime environment. The one thing that I do say, and I think it's controversial in the essay, is that we can sort of no longer afford to try to be both a continental power and a sea power simultaneously. I think it's a time of making choices, and one of the things that I'm suggesting is we make the choice that the founders laid down, which is to take up a maritime national security strategy in the world, that we use the Navy and our merchant marine as our outward influencing aspect of American policy, but we try to avoid the foreign entanglements of constantly having boots on the ground everywhere in the world, and specifically, and I called it out in there, avoiding these tripwire strategies that I'll keep just enough Americans forward that they get killed on the first day and thus trigger that the United States has to fall in behind that. I think we can do a lot of what we need to do in foreign policy and commercial policy through a maritime strategy, and I just want sort of people to make that decision or make the decision to go the other direction, but you can't try to be all things to all peoples.
Great lead into a point as we get near the last few minutes of the show. I wanted to flip the script on you a little bit. I've always thought that one of the great things about the academic traditional version of debate is you are forced to argue both sides of the question in order, along the lines that you really can't have an opinion you feel yourself if you cannot argue the opposite, the old creative friction type of thing. And which is why everybody should be well-read. If you're on the left, you need to read a lot of stuff on the right. If you're on the right, you need to read a lot of stuff on the left. It's the only way really to refine your views. And near the end of your article in The Atlantic, I'm gonna quote, I believe, the fourth to last paragraph to you. Quote, "Some voices, of course, will argue that in America's interest, diffuse and global, might be best served by expanding our commitments of land forces to places like Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and South Korea as demonstrations of American resolve, and that air and naval forces should be diminished to pay for such commitments. Others, those in the divest to invest school, believe in the promise of future technology, arguing that more traditional warfare platforms and missions should be phased out in order to fund their newer and more efficient missiles or cyber systems," unquote. So you have those two schools that you hear a lot of. The Army's been making some rather interesting statements in the last couple of years, as have the Marines in a little minor version, and also the invest to divest people that have been with us since 1991. When you hear their arguments, Jerry, and I know you read them and you talk to these people on a regular basis, on the land power side and the divest to invest, which of their arguments do you think are the strongest, and that those that want to advocate for our country being a maritime and aerospace power and to invest appropriately need to understand that land power or divest to invest point of view? in order to argue against it and to succeed in the marketplace of ideas.
All right, well, I'll finish up with this because the last two sentences in that particular paragraph, and where I say the first approach, which is the land power approach, continues a path of unnecessary entanglements. I think that the nation after 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, and for that matter, the 30 years before that, with where we had a full core forward deployed in Europe and where we had a full division always in South Korea. So the idea that the first approach of a land power approach continues a path of unnecessary entanglements. Then with regard to the divest to invest school, the second approach, I state in my essay that the second proceeds along a path of promise without proof. Because as much as we say that, hey, I'm going to pull that money back, I'm going to invest it in this new alternative future, so tell me how the railgun's coming along. Because we've been 5 years away from electromagnetic railgun for the last 25 years of my life. There's lasers. You know, how's the laser coming along? Because we've been ready for that breakthrough laser that's going to be able to shoot down any missile in the world, and we've been ready for that for 30 years, despite, you know, all the R&D investment that we've made in it. And what I remember is that, you know, the previous historical example of divest to invest, when Jackie Fisher culled the Royal Navy fleet in order to invest in Dreadnought, which everyone sort of treats as a great success, was actually as that 137 ships were removed from the fleet and removed from their forward stations around the world, actually caused an instability and helped to light off the arms race as other great European powers rushed to fill the void that was out as England pulled back at that point in time. So this is one of the reasons why I feel very strongly that the correct path forward for us is, in fact, a maritime national security strategy where we would see us increase our investments in the Navy and in the Air Force and in the Space Force, because those three occupy the three global commons, the maritime commons, the air commons, and then the space commons. I would also say the cyber commons as well, and that is where the great powers of the world today are going to test each other. They're not going to test each other in such a way that it's going to trigger a nuclear exchange between them by going, you know, mano-a-mano on land against each other's territory. They're going to test each other in the commons. And so the primary commons where they're going to test first, I think, is in the maritime oceanic environment, and that's where we need to strengthen ourselves now.
Well, that's a good place to stop, Jerry. I want to thank you for joining us today. As always, we could probably go on for several more hours and probably should at some point. But let me ask you what you got coming up next and where people can find where you're going to be putting what you're doing next.
Well, I'm trying to pull back and not write as much. So this Atlantic essay took me almost 10 months to write and get through the editorial process and get it in there. So I really enjoyed the interaction with the Atlantic staff. I'm hoping to publish with them in the future. I still will do a couple things here and there with National Review, which is sort of my natural home right now. But right now I'm trying to get out and have the conversation based upon the Atlantic essay, go up and meet with congressmen and senators who have interest in this on armed services, on commerce and transportation committees, to kind of talk about the way forward, this idea about industrial policy. I'm willing to engage with both sides of the aisle on this. I'm not a lobbyist for anybody, but I'm here to kind of talk about the Navy and the maritime environment to anyone who wants to listen to me. I also have some work that I'm doing as a private consultant where I'm doing some work for the government, doing some studies for the Secretary of Defense's office that I'm really enjoying. So I'll be up at the Library of Congress later on this week looking through the papers of Bernard Schriever. So a little geekdom for me. But, you know, right now I'm at a really good place with the publishing of this essay, and I'm just trying to continue the conversation to anyone who will listen.
Well, Jerry, it has been an absolute great hour. It's always a pleasure to talking to you, and we really appreciate you taking time. And I know you like walking and talking about your works, and we'll look forward to seeing the next thing that's got your byline on it.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
I'm alone, he wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.